Welcome to On Point, to Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Michael Brooks.
I'm Phil McKenzie.
How you doing, man?
Always doing good.
This is On Point, as everybody knows. You heard the intro. We always talk to somebody who is getting something important right and helping bring us insight. And we have with us today Rana Faruhar. She is the author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. And you're also the economics editor at Time Magazine.
I am, and the global economic analyst at CNN, if that sounds hoity-toity enough for you.
No, CNN's
not really.
Pretty blue-collar.
Fair enough.
Yeah, no,
we'll keep it clean, that's
kind of like your Greyhound job.
Ouch.
Yeah, fair enough. Rana, am I right when you talk about makers versus takers in the title of your book? Are you going back to 2012? And if so, can you explain to us that story?
Yes. So we all heard that term first used by now House Speaker Paul Ryan and later by Mitt Romney in the 2012 election cycle. And I thought a lot about that because at the time it confused me, because as somebody that covers finance, I thought, well, I know who the takers are, and they're not the 47% that aren't paying income tax because they have no money.
Right.
And what I wanted to do with this book, which is about the growth of the financial sector and how it's affected our economy, is really kind of rebrand those terms. And the starting point was one of the key statistics in my book, which is that the financial sector as a whole in America creates only 4% of jobs, but it takes 25% of all of America's corporate profits. So if you want to talk about taking, you can talk about the financial sector.
It's really interesting. I mean, I want you to explain to us, obviously, and this is really what your whole book is about, but go into a bit more detail about that journey. And, you know, this is another great time to pull on Phil's vast experience in economics and Wall Street. But the thing that was fascinating about your book, and, you know, I'm at the Majority Report. Obviously, I have a certain type of politics and a certain type of critique. It's no surprise to anybody who follows me where I fall on these issues. But what is interesting to me is that you are someone who very much obviously knows these issues very deeply, understands the sort of mechanics and the technicalities of them, but you're kind of confirming, I would say, a certain type of, I don't want to say common sense because I'm skeptical of that term, but you're saying to a lot of Americans and a lot of people who would get bogged down if they were going to debate a financial analyst, or they were going to debate someone who, you know, could explain to them, oh, no, you can't regulate derivatives because you don't understand, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
You're confirming the intuitions of, I think, many people who have seen not only the collapse, but a systemically anemic recovery in some ways, which in some ways even points, I think, even more so to the thesis of your book and the long-term trends that you're identifying than even the crash.
Well, it's interesting. I suspect that my book will be one of a number of books that will probably start coming out now. You usually, when you have a big sort of seismic event like the financial crisis, I think that there are books that come out that are just basically a recap, and I don't mean to say just, but are a recap of those events. And, you know, Andrew Ross Sorkin's book was one of those. Gillian Tett's book did some of that, and that really capture the kind of blow by blow of what happened. And then I think it does take a little bit of time and perspective that to then begin looking back, which I think tends to happen after 5 or 6 years, and you say, well, wait a minute, what really just happened? And that's kind of what my book is trying to do. And to your other point, one of the things I really wanted to get away from was this very siloed, very technocratic, very kind of BS-y, narrow conversation about, you know, what should the capital ratios be for too big to fail banks? You know, I mean, it's, first of all, it puts everyone to sleep. I mean, you know, BOB, Board of Banks. But secondly, it's not.
If only it were so.
If only it were so. Yeah. But it's also not correct. And actually, it works in favor of the financial industry because the problem is much bigger, much more systemic, and much more structural. So one of the things my book is trying to do is if you start with the too big to fail banks as the kind of heart of these concentric circles that then go outward that encompass our tax policy, our housing policy, our retirement system, you know, the way that civil society works in this country, the way education works,
our culture, what we idolize.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's all part of that. And it's been a 40-year process that has led to a fragile financial system and a what I say is a fake kind of genetically modified recovery, one that has been created by the Federal Reserve, not by real underlying change in the economy.
Absolutely.
We covered so much already. And it's funny.
I love that you're taking notes. I am taking notes. Making me a little nervous.
No. No need to be nervous.
And making me resentful.
No. It's funny that you mentioned like Andrew Ross Sorkin and his book. And it's funny because he's like an executive producer on Billions.
Yes, which I love that show, by the way.
Really?
I kind of do, because I'll tell you why. I feel like it's my, you know, it's porn viewing for me. It's like I can see amalgams of the people that I've interviewed over
this
the years.
This is what studying finance does to you.
I know.
Yeah. You got to be very
it
careful.
Turns a show about
it turns a kind of someone middling show, executive produced by Andrew Ross Sorkin, into porn.
Yeah.
Be careful.
I know. Well, there is an S&M relationship between the prosecutor. Anyway, that's another show. That's another show. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but what worries me is that there's an element of like a guy who kind of understands what's going on, not to pile on Andrew Ross Sorkin. I don't know him at all, but like the show Billions, I don't think it does what people want it to do, which is like, if you wanted this to be a serious critique of the financial markets and to make people outraged, I think it does the opposite. It makes the
It sort of glamorizes.
Yeah, it glamorizes it in a way. Like,
well, it's, you know, it is interesting because the one thing I love about the show is that it shows how literally politics and Wall Street are in bed together. You know, I mean, there is a literal S&M, you know, triangle between three characters. But I take your point. It makes the main character, the hedge fund guy, look like the better guy, like his soul is better on some level, which, you know, is obviously questionable. But hey, it's entertainment, not
analysis. It is definitely entertainment. And I think that when people, in a way, the way financialization has occurred on all levels of our society, that even if you are not a hedge fund guy, you know, if you're not SAC, if you're not Stevie Cohen, you know, people still root for these characters, even if their pension fund or their money isn't tied up in them. In a weird way, they look at these guys like heroes, you know, and that's so problematic, because at every level, these guys are taking advantage of the system.
No, it's funny. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. In a sense, they are like the great white sharks in the ocean of capitalism.
Yeah.
And so there is, on some level, in the way that people sometimes admire whoever is at the top of the food chain, you know, that is those guys. And they are, I mean, you know, it's funny. I think there's this cultural thing where you root for them, maybe even over the Jamie Dimons of the world, right? Because they appear to be sort of these lone rangers off doing their own thing, you know, making money off of the average banker's mistakes. But you're right. At the end of the day, I mean, this is how I open the lead chapter of my book, which is the story of Apple versus Carl Icahn, you know, one of the original robber barons. These are guys who are taking huge amounts of capital money out of companies that they really had no part in building, at the great expense of labor, of consumers, of the companies themselves and their long-term futures. So it's a huge issue.
Rana, I want to jump off of that, because I think another aspect of your book that's very important is it's another intuition that is going to be confirmed for people when you contrast. I mean, you know, Wall Street versus Main Street is the sort of classic political talking point. But I think people intuitively understand that it's even worse, because I think the lesson has been that if things are going quite well for Wall Street, it does not necessarily filter the Main Street, which is your work. If things go badly for Wall Street, it absolutely does filter the Main Street.
Yeah.
So they have, you know, they have the sort of worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
Can you explain specifically how, through financialization of the past several decades, the paths that we have taken in terms of internal corporate practices and policy incentives, all the sort of cluster of issues you're talking about, where we have diverged those paths so thoroughly, where when we're talking about finance, we're not talking about American business necessarily, let alone labor or small business.
Yeah, for sure. So it's interesting. And, you know, when you first posed this question, I thought, well, Wall Street has, you know, privatized the gains, socialized the losses. We kind of know that story. But the real question is something bigger, which is how, and this is what I wanted to capture in my book, how the rise of Wall Street and the power of Wall Street actually is divergent from business and right. what's good for business. Because let's step back for a minute. Okay, the way the market system, the way the capital market system is supposed to work is that financial institutions are supposed to hold everybody's savings, and then they're supposed to funnel it into productive business ventures, the idea being that businesses create jobs and ultimately underlying economic growth for society at large. The killer stat, and another killer stat, and I can't take credit for this, it's based on some really deep academic research done by some folks both in the U.S. and Europe, is that today only 15% of the capital in America's financial institutions actually goes into business investment. So what is the rest of it doing? The rest of it is being used for the buying and selling of existing assets. That's trading. A lot of it's speculative. A lot of it's short term. In some cases, we're talking about the bidding up of the real estate market. I mean, it could be any number of things. But 85% of the money is not doing what it was set up to do, which is go into business investment. So that's point number one. Point number two is that the markets have become so focused on short-term gain, and our incentive system, as you pointed out, has been set up so that CEOs and C-suite people in general at the top of America's big public firms, and public, not private, I'll come back to that in a minute, have every reason to basically jack up the share price quarter on quarter. That's what they do. So if you think about the average CEO has a shelf life of 3 years, maybe 30 to 80% of his pay is in corporate stock options. So that's why you have over the last 2 years a record amount of share buybacks. Share buybacks, you know, people go out onto the open market, buy up their shares. It artificially jacks up the share price, but it doesn't change the underlying growth story of the company. And we've seen a record number of them lately. In many times, the C-suite is borrowing money to do these buybacks. The buybacks then go to the top 10% of the population that owns 80% of the asset base. So not only does it not go on to Main Street investing in things like factories or worker training or, you know, anything you can think of that would be good for growth, it is actually increasing the wealth gap because it's going to this small sliver of Americans. And, you know, in many cases, the majority of it is going to the 0.1%. Right. You know, people like Carl Icahn who, the whole system, it just makes no sense. These are not people that actually were the capitalists that even created these companies. So that's why you have, I think, corporate earnings being tapped out. You have CEOs desperately trying to create some sense that things are going well in their companies by jacking up the share price, but you still have flat wages. And this divide where you've got market prices at a near record level and flat wages, wages that haven't increased for all Americans since the early 1990s, for working class Americans since, you know, the 70s. That it's just so Kafkaesque.
Yeah. We're in the midst of a huge Ponzi scheme.
It's a Ponzi. I mean, no doubt. It is a Ponzi scheme. It's funny. Jack Bogle, who's the founder of Vanguard Funds, who's one of the rare sort of enlightened financiers who did a deep interview for this book, called it exactly that. He said the markets have become a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's so funny because I keep laughing because I was a trader. Mm-hmm. So my job at Goldman Sachs was to, I started in healthcare, then moved on to consumer products, so Coke, Pepsi, Procter & Gamble. I was.
Yeah, she said I was.
And highly compensated to do that. And people would always ask, like it was so amazing, like when I was working there, you know, friends and family who did not understand Wall Street at all would always ask me these really deep, insightful questions. And I would be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like they would be asking like, so what do you think is the long-term picture on?
And I'm like, dude. You're like, dude, I just want to make my numbers for tomorrow.
I don't give a shit about like anything having to do with the long-term focus on any of these companies. They're just symbols and numbers on a screen for that moment.
Yeah.
And it would, the funniest thing to me would always be to laugh at people who thought they knew what was going on because they watched CNBC or they read Wall Street Journal on Barron's. I'm like,
so sad, man.
You have no idea how insignificant all of those things are. Like it only matters what's going on the desk at that moment and information that you're getting from a variety of sources.
Yeah.
And it just is the way the business is run. And so I'm wondering like how much of that is, do you think is trickling down to people to that they're getting a true sense for how honestly disconnected they are from understanding how financialization in Wall Street works?
Well, I think it's starting to happen. And I'm thinking, Michael, of what you said earlier about the complexity of the conversation. And I think what's happened is right after the financial crisis, things, you know, there's a lot of big words and jargon and, you know, things being thrown around about why we should have saved the banks. Now, I think that there's just a very clear divide. You've got market prices at record levels. You've got a recovery that is almost non-existent for most people and wages that have not gone up, you know, despite $4 trillion of money being dumped into the economy by the Fed. And by the way, $30 trillion globally by all central bankers. So this incredible amount of money out there, and it's not doing anything anymore. It's like a drug, right? You know, that people have been, the economy has been on this kind of morphine drip for many decades, I would say, and it's finally tapped out. So I think people really do feel that. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book is really paint colorful stories that people can relate to, you know, company stories that they can understand, stories about individuals and how they interact with the financial system that they can understand. Because one of the most frustrating things, and it just irritates me to no end, after covering business and the economy for 24 years, almost always when some policymaker or some financier or some corporate executive starts speaking in a way that is, you know, unintelligible, you know that they're trying to distract from your simple and usually correct question or supposition about something. Right. So
I had a debate with a Wall Street guy once, but I remember he started throwing all this jargon at me.
Yeah.
And I remember being like, right. But I watched Goodfellas, and I remember when they stuck the dynamite in the restaurant and collected the insurance money, and that's what it sounds to me like. And he was just like, yeah. I was like, right, so you should be regulated. Like, yeah. Fuck out of my face.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm curious about, though, is if in the – we're talking about the cultural impacts, but you made this point that – it's hurting business as a whole.
Yeah.
Like, right? So we know the social and labor consequences, and we should keep knowing them. And then we talk about American politics, and there's this notion that, I mean, I think everybody with any sort of sophistication knows that business sort of generally contributes to, you know, everybody, and you sort of hedge your bets, and, you know, Silicon Valley and Wall Street, in fact, contribute quite a bit to Democratic candidates and obviously Republican candidates as well. But if it's true that, you know, if we have these different clusters of the economy, I mean, we set Silicon Valley aside, but the challenge, in my view, of Silicon Valley is, I mean, partially there's tax issues, which you write about. And then there's also just the reality that, you know, there's only but so many jobs Twitter or Google can create, right? Yeah. So that's another set of challenges. But if Wall Street specifically and the way we financialized is blocking the growth of even medium-sized businesses, not just like mom-and-pop places, but potentially businesses on a scale of where they can actually start influencing the political debate.
That's a very good point.
I mean, are they still viewing themselves as, you know, on the same page because they're business versus government and labor or whoever they're positioning themselves as? Or are they starting to realize, wait a second, you're choking the arteries of the system?
It's a really interesting point. So I think that the Fortune 500 corporate executives are much more tied into Wall Street and much more beholden to Wall Street than your average small and mid-sized firm, and certainly than your average private firm. One of the other super interesting stats in the book is, again, this, it's based on a really deep 25-year academic study where public and private businesses in the same fields of the same size were compared, their behavior. Private businesses invest about twice as much into all kinds of useful things, apples for apples, as a comparative public business. So they will do more investment into factories, into worker training, into R&D, into everything.
What's your snapshot as to why? Is it purely shareholder?
It's like that they don't have the pressure. They do not have the market pressure. Right. And they will tend to be, not always, but they'll tend to be, you know, founder, family owned. They'll have somebody that has a long-term stake in this. And you will, the few exceptions that I see in the public markets behaviorally, you'll always have a founder, you know, somebody like a Steve Jobs, even a Howard Schultz, somebody that can, you know, push back enough that they can get a few things through. When you have a CEO for hire in a big public firm, they're going to do what the street says. And actually, one thing that's been really interesting as I put this book out there, I kind of thought I was going to get calls from a lot of Fortune 500 CEOs being like, yeah, somebody's finally sticking up for us. We're having such a hard time. Not at all. Interestingly, though, I did get calls from some very high-level financiers. And this is – it's almost the sort of thing that proves the rule. The people at the very top of the capitalist food chain are starting to see that this is a growth issue that is hitting their portfolios. So they are looking out and saying, uh-oh, returns are not looking good for the next 20, 30 years. Guess what? It's because of this fact that the system is eating itself, and they want to understand that better and then know how to trade on it.
It's like we talk about it. It's like if you read the financial if you read The Economist, in my experience, it's a little bit more middle brow, so it's like still more, you know, yeah, this is great, blah, blah, blah. But if you read like the Financial Times, there's much more sort of editorial space for on all of these issues. Like, wait a second, this actually might pose a challenge.
Oh, yeah, the FT is fabulous. I think it's very high quality. And they also understand the connection, the interaction between political risk and the financial markets right now, which the Wall Street Journal, like, hello, what planet? I mean,
they're lost.
Well, they think Hillary Clinton is like a serial killer. I mean, they got other stuff to worry about.
Yeah.
Right. Hillary Clinton filmed killing Vince Foster. I don't have time to worry about that.
They're busy chasing conspiracy theories.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And not the real ones.
Yeah, right. Not the real ones. And it's funny, but tragic that you focus on like MBAs, and I am an MBA, and
know thine enemy.
Yeah, it's okay. I'm recovering MBA, but
I can see that.
One of the things.
Wow.
But what?
I didn't know that Rana would come through with the first piece of shade of the show.
No, respect. I am because I think MBAs can be useful, but not in the manner which is currently constructed.
Yeah,
and. When I was at school, we laughed at like the marketing kids. Like basically, if you weren't a finance kid, you were like, fuck out of here. Like you were just.
Yeah, you're lower on the food chain.
Yeah, you're lower on the food chain. Like what you're talking about is kind of like, it's not measurable. Yeah, it's touchy-feely. Yeah. We laughed at those kids, you know. Right. And what I've noticed in my career as a finance guy that left finance and went into now marketing. Mm. And things that are slightly more creative, like ad agency work, which isn't marketing, it's creative work, is that, and this will dovetail to your comment, Michael, about Silicon Valley, is that I feel the finance world has polluted all of those other worlds.
And even on like the cultural level.
The cultural level. So they'll use the language. Mm. Like finance language is opaque. It's designed to be confusing. You know, it's formulas, there's a lot of mumbo jumbo. And later on in my life cycle, once I left Goldman, was that I was sitting in meetings with people at Coke, Procter & Gamble, Jaguar, and they're trying to use the same mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
And traditional marketing people weren't able to shut them down because now they're confused.
Yeah.
Whereas, right. As a Wall Street guy now doing that role, I was like, the fuck are you talking about? Like
that's so great.
Nonsense.
Yeah. That's powerful. That's
so I was able to shut them down because I had like better opaque nonsense to their nonsense.
It's all about who has the best opaque nonsense.
Dude, it's like Bourdieu, man. You ever read Bourdieu?
But my point is that I feel like people now, because the investment isn't going where it's supposed to and there's no innovation really, everyone's trying to justify their work.
Right.
And their job using like a lot of like smoke and mirrors and you see it in big data.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm going to be super fascinated to see where big data takes this whole trend too, because it's taking it to the nth degree. I actually have a chapter on exactly this phenomenon. And, it's interesting. I almost pulled off and did a whole book on this topic because it was so fascinating. In some ways, the beginnings of all this was with the WizKids and Robert McNamara, who, you know, orchestrated the failed U.S. Vietnam War effort. And this is a guy who, you know, went on to, well, he had run Ford Motors, then at the Pentagon, then dean of the Harvard Business School. And the World Bank. Exactly. Yeah. Good point. Even worse. Exactly. Mumbo jumbo.
We're not going to melt him with napalm anymore. Now we just, you know,
we're just going to make him all new on the rolls.
Yeah. We'll just throw him in some sweatshops. All right.
Yeah, exactly. No, but it's this kind of, if you can measure it, you can manage it, losing the force forest for, you know, for these trees of data points, and thinking that if it can't be genetically or financially engineered on a balance sheet, that it's not worth anything, the thinking is so tapped out, it's become destructive. And in fact, one of the reasons I did the MBA chapter is I was talking to a bunch of CEOs just in the course of my journalism. And several of them were saying, you know, we just aren't even hiring from MBA programs anymore. And I'm like, what? And, you know, these are big companies that could have gone in and hired, you know, the whole class of Harvard. And I said, well, what's the deal? What are you not getting? And they said, well, they're still being taught sort of finance 101, marshal your capital. Labor is a cost, not an asset. And they're like, the world has changed. I mean, the world is awash in money. As I said, you know, central banks globally have dumped $30 trillion into the economy in the last 8 years. What is rare is human capital that is adaptable enough, you know, labor that is adaptable enough to basically move quickly in the way the economy is moving, the digital economy. And it's just a whole different mindset. And it's not being taught well in business schools. And it's interesting. Nitin Noria, who's the dean of Harvard, did a very deep interview for my book. He also did a piece which seems sort of half-hearted to me in the Wall Street Journal, sort of defending Harvard's business school program. Which, you know, I mean, they've got good professors and bad professors, but I think that there's real pressure from the financial donors to some of these schools. There's pressure from some of the graduates, the very powerful financier graduates of these schools, to kind of keep things the way they are. But business really needs something different in terms of education right now.
That actually is really interesting, because I want to get, before we end, we'll sort of get to the sort of main sort of macro policy prescriptions you have for all of us. But I'm also really interested in that aspect of business school, the business school conversation from the perspective of this show. You know, a very big part of our audience. I mean, everybody listens to us, and it's a great show. I'll do a Trump plug. I mean, look, it's fantastic, and frankly, everybody loves it, and everybody listens to it. I mean, look, it's
they
great.
Have no choice.
They're almost sick by how good it is. But I think, but a big part of our audience is definitely people who are, you know, creative professionals in some form or another. And I think that this actual contrast, again, that is pointed to you in your book and your work, between the sort of demands of being that type of member of the labor market that you're talking about, someone who's incredibly adaptive, someone who is able to see angles and compete in an incredibly complex world, which especially, you know, if you don't have sort of, depending on your socioeconomic background, is a whole other question in terms of getting in the wrong if you're doing unpaid internships. I mean, a whole sort of cycle. And then the contrast between, like, it's almost as if you're saying to the labor force, particularly people sort of emerging in it, you need to run like a triathlon to succeed. And then at the same time, we have a very meager social safety net. And then the financialization is sort of reified to just, and as I hear you, and correct me if I'm wrong, just sort of recycle money almost in a couple of just sort of clogged arteries that loop.
Absolutely. It's funny. I'm thinking about another interview that I did today about the book, and the interviewer said to me, well, you know, what's so bad about finance? Didn't finance pay back all that TARP money? And I thought, well, nobody's arguing that they don't know how to make money. You know, I mean, that's one thing that's not the issue. It's, are they funneling this money? Are they actually doing, are financial services, and I stress the word service, serving society and the economy? By and large, sadly, the answer is no. And that's just one of many headwinds, as you say. I mean, this trend of financialization runs in tandem to globalization, runs in tandem to technology-related job disruptions. I will say one thing I'm very interested in, and this is kind of where I'm throwing my own reporting efforts in the next year. I think there is one upside to technological change right now, which is that platform technologies, digital technologies, you know, the same technologies that have allowed Uber to exist, can, if we get the policy measures right, be used to increase the labor share as well. And I'm thinking of things like, for example, Swift, the driver, the disgruntled Uber drivers that banded together to create their own software, you know, app and car service in New York. That you can now happen. So you can now circumvent the existing capital system, these sort of monopoly structures, but it requires policy shifts that make it possible for people to have healthcare. And, to, you know, we need portable benefits. We need all kinds of structures to make that shift possible. But if we had those structures, I mean, knock on wood, and the next, next president will do that, this could really be a change point. And so that's my one kind of optimistic note. And I'm going to be doing a lot of reporting on that in the next year.
That's fascinating. What is the sort of what are the kind of main policy sort of blueprints coming out of this book? I mean, you know,
so I've got kind of, I try not to get too bogged down in the details because, you know, there's a lot of stakeholders that should be part of that conversation. But I have kind of five baskets of solutions. The first one is a kind of a big existential thing, which is we have had, I think, a mythology in this country that financial services are the top of the economic pyramid, that you go from being an agricultural country to a manufacturing powerhouse to a services economy to finance. It's at the top.
It's almost
you know?
Like a religious narrative.
It's like actually, that's no, yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And if you remember, I don't know, like, you know, back in the late 90s, London and New York were actually competing openly for who could, you know, bring in the most financial business, who was the most attractive place. And we should flip that triangle and, you know, make financial services just this bottom layer serving the rest of the economy. Mm-hmm. And that would be much healthier. And frankly, that's the way Adam Smith, who's the father of modern capitalism, set it up. By the way, in his era, most businesses were private. Most of them were small or mid-sized. They were very much like direct to customers.
Well, all so you of the analogies from Adam Smith are like, you make shoes.
Yeah, yeah,
you,
right,
it's,
exactly.
It's never it's, like, you, know, you have a giant behemoth that recycles money on itself.
Yeah,
and your friend from another bank
options and pricing them differently and all
to,
exactly.
to mess with the LIBOR
which we did
score.
Every day.
You see how it works.
Exactly.
It wasn't taking a billionaire out of, like, I don't know, $4 billion of their Yahoo stock. That billionaire shall remain nameless.
Yes, exactly.
So we can
right,
figure
right,
out
exactly.
who that is.
We
pre-market
know.
Trading.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So we got to change that narrative. I mean, there's also...
That would actually be a funny book, though. Adam Smith of the 21st century.
You could, like, little words of wisdom. It would sit right by the checkout counter at Barnes & Noble. But there's practical stuff, too. I mean, the tax code, there's so much low-hanging fruit in the tax code. And actually, you know, this is an interesting place, I think, for bipartisan agreement. I mean, it's funny, I'm obviously a liberal, but I grew up in the rural Midwest. And I saw a lot of small, private, you know, conservative business owners that are just as frustrated about all these things because they're on the short end of that business stick.
Well, they're in the mid-sized business.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And so I think that, you know, people should really cull the tax code, find all the ways that it is supporting debt rather than equity. I mean, there's just so much we could do with that. I could go on, but you can read the book. You can buy the book.
Yeah, everybody should buy the book. It is a very, very good book. Do you have any last...
Oh man, all my stuff is super philosophical. Like I'm just
I
all
love
over
philosophical.
The place, you know? But I'm just like,
we
just
got to
get rid of money. Like
ooh,
I'm a super
deep.
Like this
that's
is my
deep.
This is my final Federation Star yeah, Trek great. Nerd guy. Like
it takes when you work at Goldman. Yeah. It's when you
if
really
we're gonna
like,
unlock God. All of this, we got to get rid of money. Like the time for it is past.
What do we
over.
Replace with money? We go back to barter system,
dude. I don't know. The Federation did it.
Are there any just, more like you? Are there a bunch of like ex-Goldman people that are
yeah.
like
I actually
want to
do
–
I shouldn't
together.
Even share this on air, but like I feel like –
They're going to come out with a hit.
No, they won't. They don't care. But like ex-Goldman I think is some of the most powerful network out there. Like ex-Goldman people are killing it. There's a lot of us out here.
Oh, I'm sure you – but are there people that have like – You know, they've come so full circle.
Yeah.
That, oh, interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Interesting.
There's a lot. That's the crazy thing about the firm. Like, it was, it truly was the best place to be. I loved it. Like, you know, I loved the people. They were really cool. Like, they weren't, like, as bad as people might think nowadays because the firm was different, you know.
Yeah.
Was Corzine still ahead of it when you started there?
Yeah, when I joined, Corzine was still the head and... It was a partnership, and it was just transitioning into being a big public firm. And
there you go.
Then there was the coup, and you know
Paulson
took over, and it changed. Right. And
well, I'm counting on Gary Gensler. If Hillary gets elected, I'm hoping Gary Gensler's ex Goldman.
Yeah,
but he's you know somebody that I think really knows what's going on in the street, has good ideas about fixing it. I mean, hopefully she'll recruit some of those people.
Yeah.
In addition to the usual suspects, which we will remain nameless anyway.
Jill Stein. You don't have to name them. Yeah. We will name them. Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. Rana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was awesome. We could have gone on forever, so we'll just have to keep talking. Yeah,
would you come back, hang out more with us?
I will totally come back and hang out more.
That would be awesome.
The book is thank you.
Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. It's a really good book, and it's not intimidating.
No, I recommend it highly.
It's super readable.
I'm loving it. It's great, and I'm totally geeking off on it. So
take it to the beach.
Everybody.
Yeah. Take it to the lake.
Take it everywhere.
I did. I actually literally did read some of the book at a lake last week. That's no lie. I was up in Massachusetts.
And I was on a beach.
I love it.
He was in Barbados and rural Massachusetts. Covering a lot of bases.
Right. So it's super international.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.